This episode of the Deck Tease Podcast is brought to you by Grand Prix Portland. Join Cascade Games and Channel Fireball on August 7th through the 10th for the Team Sealed main event, with $63,000 in prizes, as well as side events firing all 4 days and panels featuring your favorite Magic personalities. Go to gppdx.com for more information. And welcome to episode 96 of the Deck Tease Podcast. I am your host, Aaron Campbell. My guest tonight is the man behind the hugely successful Bump in the Night podcast. He is the one, the only, DJ Spruik. Hello.
Hello, Aaron. Thank you for having me on the Deck Tease.
Thank you for agreeing to come on the Deck Tease.
So I'm Spruik, and I've been playing Magic for pretty much my entire life.
I have to ask you the questions first.
Oh, dang.
I'm just glad you're feeling better, as I remember you had to cancel last week because you were sick.
Yeah, just these things happen. There's never a good time to get sick, but it's all over now.
That's okay. That's okay. I was just worried about you.
Oh, you're too sweet.
Well, I'm glad to have you here. And I have to say, Spruik, I enjoy you for numerous reasons. The first reason I enjoy you is because your voice is really your voice. And I know we kind of joked about this when I met you at GP Minneapolis. I was convinced that, because when you do bump in the night, you have what I call a DDR voice, where you have the hello, and you're very, you know, I was convinced that that was an affectation. And I had it in my mind, I imagined it where I would meet you, and you would be like, yeah, what do you want? And like, you wouldn't sound anything like I hear you to sound. But when I tapped you on the shoulder and was like, are you DJ Spruik? You were like, hello, and that's your real voice.
Yes, that's probably one of the number one comments I get from people is that they are surprised that I sound exactly like they thought I would sound, which isn't how they thought I would sound. So I think normally people are used to, you know who I always think is a good example of this is like Gilbert Gottfried.
Okay.
There is no footage anywhere of him ever talking in a voice other than the Gilbert Gottfried voice. Mm-hmm. But I can't see that being his all-the-time voice. I know he has to, like, go home and be like, hi, honey, it was a long day at the office. But, like, if you see him in public, people always try and catch him. They're like, hey, aren't you Gilbert Gottfried? And it's like, yes, what do you want? But, yeah, that's it's really how I sound. I'm just incredibly enthusiastic. It is a nasal voice. It's unique. It took me a long time to learn how to sing with it. Took me a very long time to learn to be okay with the way it sounds in my songwriting, but I eventually got there. You know, it took a lifetime to figure out how to mix it, but it's finally in a place now where I think the unique elements of the voice really add to the music. So, yeah, and a lot of people can pick me out by my voice at things. So people don't recognize me at cons by my face, but because they hear me talking and they're like, that sounds like Bump in the Night.
Yeah, I get that too. I remember I was at a Gen Con last year, and this was right around the time the show had started to pick up steam, and there was a listener named Daniel Hall, and I think I was in between rounds of some event, and he comes up to me and he goes, are you Aaron Campbell? And I was like, yeah, and he was like, I could tell by your voice. He's like, I heard your voice in the crowd, and I was like, that's the Deck Tease. And I've heard that quite a lot, actually. I went to a PTQ once and had something similar happen, so I can definitely relate to that, where people may not know what I look like, but they hear my voice, and it's almost like, you know, that one ping in the middle of the crowd where they're like boop 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 boop, and they just sort of zero in on me, and that's really cool. That's cool that people associate us like that.
Aw, yeah, sonically recognizable.
Yes. So I want to talk about you because you're a big deal, and I know I've said this to some of my guests before, but you have over 600,000 followers on Twitter. You are the only guest I've ever had on that actually has the little blue verified check. Like, you're mainstream.
Yeah, thank you. I've bridged magic and music in a way that the magic community is really my home, but I have some success from music, which is great. The internet does crazy things for, small artists, and I've been good with social media. Basically, the timeline kind of how things went is, first the gathering with Patrick Chapin happened, which obviously I can expand on that for any length of time, but that initially got people knowing who I was, and it just got my name out there, and I made a lot of friends. It's so hard to explain to people who I have that are Luddites, like people in my family, that I have all these friends that I've never met. And it's like, you've never even met them. Aren't they creepy? Isn't that bad with the internet? It's like, no, you don't understand. I know some of these better than people that I've seen every day in real life. So I made a lot of friends in the magic community, which is great. But then when I started doing Bump in the Night, I think that people really took to the fact that it was just a lot of giving, like, I just want to make a soundtrack for people every week and they can count on it. And so that like every Monday morning I'm going to have another like hour of entertainment that's just going to be really good for your workout or your drive or anything. And I think that word of mouth spread really quickly. Being on MTG Cast helped a lot because those guys are great. And then I had some crossover success with my regular Spruik stuff because my LP Lies Synth Pop Told Me was pretty well reviewed.
I love that title, by the way.
Oh, thank you. The music videos in particular for Morning Sex and Sold did very well. And that took me up. That's when I got up over about 10 or 15,000 followers. And at that point, Twitter gets weird. So eventually, once you have that many followers, things start happening without you really understanding why. There's a lot of automated accounts or tastemakers that just follow and retweet and favorite people who have a lot of follows because they're clearly worth following. And it gives you a certain level of notoriety. And at this point, I'd be crumbling under. I'd be crumbling under server bills if I really had 600,000 people streaming Bump in the Night every week. But suffice to say that, half of them are real. The other half, I think, is weird Twitter air. And I'm not afraid to admit it. Twitter is weird. And like One Directioners show up and tell me I'm cute and ask if I would please ask One Direction to follow them and then leave when I don't. And it's like, what? This is weird. Go away.
Yeah, I definitely get that a little bit too. How important is it for you to remember your roots in magic and remember the fact that you're a gamer and that that helped get you here?
I'm in no danger of losing those roots. It's hardly like once I win my Grammy or go on my international tour, I'm going to be really excited to like party with supermodels or, do lots of cocaine every night. I think that the last time I toured, my backstage area was me with my iPad playing Hearthstone on it. It's me at my very happiest is me playing games.
You actually said something that was very interesting in an interview that I found of yours. And you said, and I quote, "Fame and fortune can suck it. I need enough fame that a few dozen people can write me back and warm my heart and say, 'Man, Spruik, that last song really spoke to me and changed how I thought,' and enough fortune that I can eat. The rest can take a hike." Do you still feel that way?
I definitely do, because having the level of success I have has allowed me, it's not excessive by any means, but it's enough that I can refocus on what makes me happy about it. And so I realized that, when I said that, it's kind of like a lot of people, especially musicians, but maybe even sometimes magic personalities, especially musicians though, they really want to get famous. And then what? And it's like, but then how will you be happy? And Now I, you know, from a lot of grinding and hard work and like releasing albums and keeping up the cast, I do have the audience, and it's like, what do I do with it? And it's like, well, the audience in and itself doesn't make me happy. What makes me happy is that sometimes when I've got something I really want to get off my chest musically, or I have a track I made and I think it's really cool, when I was younger, those used to just have to disappear into the aether. You know, they would just, I remember it was as little as like 8, 9 years ago, a young college age Billy would make a song he thought was really cool and nobody would really hear it but a person he posted on a forum. And now it's kind of cool that I can put it up, and by the time I wake up in the morning, I know that a lot of people have left feedback or just said like, hey, this was really cool, I liked it, or it made me think. And that justifies and helps make it cool that I'm an artist, because I was making those tracks all this time for me anyway. But the real charm and the fulfillment also comes in the sharing.
Has fame changed you in other ways at all?
No, I don't think so. It's put me in touch with a lot of cool people, is all. I've only been recognized on the street a few times. And it's funny because I kind of did things in the reverse order. The conventional wisdom is supposed to be like with musicians, you're supposed to get turf going locally and like dominate your hometown and build like a street team and then start getting world renowned. But the internet has like changed, turned that on its head. So like my main product is the radio show, and I kind of got, you know, internet popular first, which puts me in an interesting place because, you know, I can have tens of thousands of people listening to the cast every week online, but when I go and play somewhere in real life, I can usually pull like 50 or 100 people to see me because the fans are distributed all over the world. And so that's actually a funny coincidence that like a lot of people are have real world fans and are trying to establish the online presence, and I have the online presence and trying to concentrate it to more real world fans.
Maybe you each could learn something from each other.
I like my side of it.
Yeah?
The radio show makes me happy. So I guess what I was saying with like the happiness earlier is a lot of weeks making Bump in the Night is the most enjoyable thing that happens to me the whole week. Which isn't meant like, sorry, the way I said that sounded kind of sad
No,
or
not at
like you,
all.
but like I have a blast. I am dancing like crazy in my room. People who may have seen video footage of me dancing while I DJ, it is a sight to be seen. Like I'm flailing every which way. It is fun. There's even some weeks where I'm like, oh, I don't really feel like doing it this week, but then I do, and I'm energized. And it is like knowing that I'm doing that, and then that's going to like be improving the days of people. You know, just tons of people out there is really humbling, and it lets me know like how I'm helping people. I'm sorry, I get a little less verbose or eloquent when I'm like feeling really warm.
You're totally fine. And I think it shows in your work too. Like I said, going back to your voice, you know, when you're recording Bump in the Night, that's really you. You're really excited to be there. You're really, you know, you really love what you do. And, you know, I think if your voice were an affectation, it'd be a lot easier to hide that. Like, you know what I mean? If that came out right. But
That's
I think
my friend Travis Allen. So shout out to Travis. He approached me once and asked, he's like, I have to ask you about Bump in the Nights. He's like, I have to ask, is the level of energy that you're yelling at when you do the voiceovers and you're all like, oh my God, that last track was massive and it was from so and so. He says, is that you know, a put on? 'Cause he says, I don't know what would surprise me more. It would seem kind of weird that you're just in your basement, like all alone by yourself, shouting at the top of your lungs. But at the same time, that wouldn't shock me at all because that's what you're like. I'm like, yeah, I'm all by myself, and I'm just like, oh my God, people, that bass!
Well, I love it. I'm sure your listeners do too. I don't think that needs to change at all. So I want to go all the way back, Spruik. I want to talk about you as a child. So you grew up in Buffalo, correct?
Yes,
Okay.
born and raised.
Born and raised. Were you always interested in music as a kid?
Yeah, I got into music when I found installed on my Windows 3.1 computer Microsoft MIDI Studio. It
Wow.
was very old staff notation music composition thing. And it was, I taught myself to read music out of that program, and I taught myself music theory out of that program. So it was something that I was just screwing with all the time as a kid. Like, I think I found that software when I was 8 or 9, and I would just put notes everywhere and see how they sounded. And just sort of self-taught, I learned about, just at first, like, oh my God, sharps and flats? You mean there's twice as many notes as I thought there were? I'm like 10, and I didn't know what they did. So I was kind of scared of flats for a while. I only used sharps. It took a while for me to figure out that those were the same thing. But seriously, then I like self-learned chords and chord progressions. And it got me interested enough in music that by the time I was graduating high school, I'd actually like figured a lot of it out. And I went to college for music composition and took music theory and sort of officialized and formalized my informal music composition knowledge.
So how did that lead to you getting started as a DJ, like that being your career and being professional?
So basically, I'd always been writing music this whole time, and I'd had a lot of success as a producer after college. After I turned away from writing academic music, like the symphonies and the string quartets, I started producing electronic music, and that was going and has been going very well. But there just came a point where I had at various intervals tried to perform it live, quote unquote. And there's always a really tough thing when you're a producer making electronic music. How do you perform live? And there are people who try and play their keyboards live, or people who bring on live drummers, or turn some of the synth parts into guitar parts. But really, I saw just so many people who were not ashamed to just be DJs. They're producers, but like, their performances is DJing it. And that's actually very cool and very accepted. And so that's the route I wanted to go. And I made the move into DJing. I had a friend, Nitronic from Buffalo. That's Nicholas Cummings. So thank you, Nick. Teach me how to DJ. Ran with it from there, and then fell in love with it. And it's almost taken priority now over production. Sometimes they still work together, because the things I learn from DJing help me produce tracks better. And when I produce tracks, I can add them to my own sets. But it's DJing is way out in the lead now, and I'm hungry to do it as much as I can. The radio show lets me get in there at least once a week, but I'm still always booking clubs and parties and cons and stuff on the side too, because it is just, it's not like work. It's just magical, It's like throwing a dance party for myself that I get to sculpt.
That's awesome. I read that you were active until 2006, and then you took a break from being a DJ to finish your last year of college. I've had several pros on the show, and I understand that being a DJ is a little different than being a pro player, but the point is you still have a great interest in something. Who made that decision to either put school on hold or put whatever on hold to pursue that dream? Was it hard for you to walk away from being a DJ temporarily to finish school?
Not really, because it's something that your passion has to be there to do. And so when other things got more important, it was natural for them to be more important. I had to focus on my symphony, and that took, because that was the project for the duration of my senior year, and that was a full-time musical commitment. And then it takes you a while to get back into the swing of things. You take some time after college to date and find yourself, take up new hobbies, other things. And then I came back to it in 2009, when the itch came up again.
Was it hard being away from the hobby that you love?
Oh, not so much. But I mean, when it got hard, I
Yeah.
came back. In the meantime, I was, playing more Magic than I used to, biking a lot, getting established in my day career because it was time to put that, newfound degree to work.
So let's talk about magic. Now, you told me how old you were when you discovered music and in your childhood with music. Tell me about the first time you discovered magic.
I discovered magic in fifth grade. It was 1994. It was in the lunchroom. Yeah, that's the stuff. Basically, my friend Brendan, I think, was the first. Everybody picked it up at like the same time, so I'm having a hard time remembering who was
Sure.
first. If somebody shows up, and this is with revised era cards, and even, the dark Fallen Empires revised, that's what was out at the time. And the old cards looked so cryptic
Yeah.
and like a window into a different world. I was already a kid who had been reading the Dungeons and Dragons manuals as bedtime reading, like for the last several years. I thought they were the coolest things ever. All I wanted to do was play video games and play board games. And then your friend shows up with these weird, dark, almost ominous looking art. You've got cards like Murk Dwellers and
Demonic
Frozen
Tutor.
Jade. Demonic Tutor is another one. I saw like Word of Command or Burrowing and stuff like that. And I'm like, what does this mean? Oh my God, there's parts here. There's these numbers. Like, get me into this. And so, that was my Crawworm is the best card ever printed phase. And then I just kept playing and never stopped. It's been constant this whole time. I sold out twice and bought back in afterwards both times. I'm never selling out again. I know better now.
What is it that keeps you coming back?
I think that there is, first off, I have not done anything in my life as long as I've played Magic the Gathering, other than possibly eaten and slept. But it has been, it occupies a wider time frame of my life than being a musician. It occupies a longer time frame of my life than being an athlete. A longer time of my life than being post-pubescent and caring about the opposite sex or anything. Like, as an interest, it dwarfs all other interests. And I don't think turning away from that part of me is an option. There's been times when I lost interest. Sometimes there was a lame corset. And for a summer, like ninth edition would come out and I just kind of wouldn't play much. But then even if I had been enjoying having my Fridays back and doing things with them other than FNM, somebody's like, oh my God, did you see there's a card in the new set? I'm like, oh, a new set came out, right? And then I look at it and I'm back in and I'm buying packs the next week. It's so appealing. I don't know what else to say.
Yeah, for me it's the people. I played right I started playing right around the time that you did. Ice Age was really big. I remember, Siobhan Dragon, Jester's Cap, Hylaptris Lemur, Lurgoyf, those were the first cards that I was exposed to. And then I played, but I don't really think that I really played. Like I played at like local card shops, but I played as much as you can at 14, 15 with babysitting money as your sole source of income. And then I stopped playing for about 10 years, and I played Vampire the Masquerade for a while, LARPed for full dork points. I was a LARPer. I did that for a while, and then I played World of Warcraft for 6 years. And when you play a game where your microphone is like a leash and you're tethered to your computer and you're hiding behind a computer screen, you know, you really start to crave human interaction. And, you know, I went back to magic because I really wanted to be around people again that I could see and I could talk to and I could touch. And for me, that was why I played as a teenager, because I made great new friends out of it. And now that's why I'm playing again as an adult, because I'm meeting so many amazing people. Like, I'm traveling to events and going back to sort of what you said about the Twitter followers, you know, these are my friends. And even though they may not be tangible or they may not live down the street, I'm making so many friends from this hobby. And that's what keeps me playing. So.
Very cool. I love the people as well. I would say in my case, it hasn't been the people, although almost all my best friends in my life are people I have played Magic with at some point in my life. I've got people who are my friends today because we played together in middle school. I've got people who are my friends today because we played together last week. But at no point have I, there's nobody I play with today that I played with, you know, 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's the people come and go, but the friendships remain, even as the people enter the hobby and leave the hobby. I think that in my case, it's more that there is something in the structure of the game that is inherently appealing. I don't think you could get me to swear it off. I could be clean, you know, for 5 years, and then you could say, would you believe that they printed a card that does a thing where it adds mana to your pool whenever a person reveals a card from their hand? I'm like, I can't believe it, and then I'm playing. It's like the tiniest taste. I like, they made a card that does that? I have to see it.
I can actually say that I am still friends with the girl who introduced me to the game for the first time, and that she still plays as well. My friend Sam Lemieux, we were friends in junior high, 7th grade, Miss Hilmer's class. I will never forget it. And I remember when I came back to the game, I came back around Innistrad, and I started going to my local game store's Friday Night Magic. And she came with her husband. And it was so funny because we felt like the grizzled veterans where, you know, people would open their packs of, you know, M13 or whatever. And they would be like, ew, Siobhan Dragon, that card is useless. And she would look at me and she'd be like, do you remember the first time I showed you a Siobhan Dragon? And I remember how awesome it was. And, you know, you would make a comment about something being reprinted and they would be like, I remember Avacyn Restored, we were at the pre-release and Grizzlebrand was a thing. And she had made a comment about Lord of the Pit. And she was like, doesn't this remind you of Lord of the Pit? And some little tenderoni was like, what's that? And I was like, yeah, we're old. but we're still friends. And she plays Magic. She lives in Japan with her husband. And yeah, she's the one who all those years ago got me into it. And her uncle owned a card store down the street from my house, R&M Sports Cards. And yeah, through all the years, she still plays. And that's a great feeling. So
that reaction takes me right to the question, as long as you're on the topic of my favorite card, because yeah. Everyone asks me my favorite card, and okay. For that very reason, it's Hymn to Turok.
Really?
Because when I was in my Crawworms phase at the beginning, and like you were saying about Shivan Dragon, there's a lot of cards that you initially are excited about that as adults you know aren't good anymore. And so as a 10-year-old, I thought the most busted thing you could do on turn one was Dark Ritual into Urg Raiders and Unholy Strength. Like, wow, turn one, I've got a 4/4. Yeah, so what if it has to attack? I was going to do that with my 4/4 anyway. And like now today, I know that that is not one of the coolest things you can be doing. In fact, I was wrong about everything, except when I was, you know, 10 and 11, I adored Hymn to Turok. I knew it was good. I put it in everything I made. And today, that knowledge still holds up. It's still a totally viable card. It's a staple of legacy decks that can cast it because its power level is high. And so that card has a special spot in my heart for being of the 24 things I thought were cool as preteen Billy, it's the only one I was right about.
And is that in your favorite deck?
Let's see. Favorite deck. It has been in many of my favorite decks, but
Okay.
my favorite deck ever is Extended Era Rock
Yeah.
when Extended ran from Tempest onwards. So it was not the old Extended that had Trix and Necro in it. It was around 2003 when Extended comprised Tempest up through, I want to say, almost Kamigawa. Mm-hmm. And you could play Rock decks that had Birds of Paradise, Ravenous Baloths, Yavimaya Elders, but also Vampiric Tutors to find very particular answers or even Living Wishes to get specific things out of the sideboard, like Viridian Shamans, Spirit Mongers, Dust Bowls. That deck, I got my first ever ninth with it, and you know, it was the first of many ninth places, so it has a place in my heart. I played it at several tournaments, and I always felt confident behind the helm, and it ruined me for a long time because I wanted to play that pernicious deed board control kind of deck in every format for like the next decade, even when, you know, black green, it seems silly right now because black green is so good.
No, I agree with you. I was actually playing the I played the Rock in the last rotation that happened. I was playing a version of the Rock that revolved around Thrag Tusk and Mutilate and Desecration Demon and Disciple of Bolas, and I fell in love with the Rock like you did. And I agree with you. I can relate to you in the sense of wanting to always play it, and I still miss that deck, and I still find myself, you know, whenever a new set comes out, looking at the black and green cards and going, can I bring that deck back? And just something about Rock decks, I totally get it.
It existed at a point in time where there was a charm to getting incremental value in ways that I don't believe really exist as much today, except in the grindiest of control matches. Mm-hmm. But really, so many cards are haymakers, and one extra activation out of a Jace Architect of Thought is, you know, just handing you cards.
Yeah.
But there, it used to not be that easy. And there was an art in that old Rock deck where you, the best feeling in the world was like sacrificing the Yavimaya Elder, getting the two lands as well as a card, and Eternal Witnessing it back. And it's sort of like, are you actually going to deal the opponent any damage or control the board? I mean, don't worry about it, guy. I'm getting there. Let me get 11 lands in play. And actually, are you familiar with my Gathering song, Still Had All These?
Yes.
So in the second verse, I discuss a Still Had All These with an opponent who wants to use Genesis, Survival of the Fittest, and recur up Shriek Maws to go ahead and slowly grind out the opponent's board state. That's me, not anyone I've actually played, but that one is me making fun of my own mindset when I used to be this deck in Extended, which was like, look, you know, the why attack with the Ravenous Baloth and end the thing when it's up, like, oh, I could draw another card here and make them discard their hand. And I had to get over it, but the impulse is still there.
Well, you will have to send me one of those lists for your favorite deck, and I can throw it up in the blog post that accompanies the show, and people can look at it and ogle it and possibly even buy it if they like it.
There wouldn't be much point in buying the deck list I'll send you. It's a bygone point in time. I don't believe oversold cemeterying back Ravenous Rats and Birds of Paradise is what it used to be.
Well, there are casual formats, and, you know, not everybody plays at the competitive level, and I believe in the dream. You know, you mentioned being a teenager or being young and believing that certain cards are good and possibly losing that feeling when you get older. And I have to say, I've had that feeling as of a few years ago. I thought Splinter Fright was the best thing ever when Innistrad came out and Dark Ascension came out, and I believed in that card, and I tried so hard to make a deck out of that card. And even now, you know, I have my fingers crossed that one day Splinter Fright will come back and it's going to be awesome, and I will show everybody who told me it could not be done. So I still believe. I'm all about the dream. So I want to go back to talking about your followers for a little bit, because we talked about, how big you are and how many followers you have in your audience. Was there a moment where you thought to yourself that you've made it or that you've arrived? Like, have you felt that at all?
Not really,
No.
because I mean, the verification is pretty cool, but frankly, I know that it's just that I'm very good at social media, and I know what they represent, which is that I'm not, this isn't, meant to be some false humility or anything, but there are people who are doing way better at music with fewer followers than me, touring the country, drawing big crowds. My follower count is strictly reflective of my very popular radio show, which is okay, but it's just that that's a really popular radio show. So I know that I don't think that it should go to my head, or that I should think that I have more of a voice than people, or have any special importance. I'm just doing something particularly well suited to the Twitters. Granted, when I saw that I got verified, that was seriously pretty cool. I am very active on social media. I joke a lot. I tweet almost constantly, only sometimes about music, very frequently about magic, and a lot of times just this absurdist IT humor. And sometimes I tweet a lot about politics and social justice, because I can't really hide my liberalism, which has cost me a couple fans, but I don't really care. Anyway, there's no moment I think I made it, though, because it's sort of, when I crested like 100,000, I'm like, that makes sense. That's how many listeners the podcast has. And then when I crested, 500,000, I'm like, that makes sense. That's not how many listeners the podcast has, but that's how much garbage Justin Bieber crap I accumulated. But
If
it
you,
is
I'm sorry.
pretty. No, I was just going to say, it's neat to have that kind of an audience, but I don't ever want to be like, do you know how many followers I have? Because it is just another form of the, is there a good gender neutral term for like internet dick or something? What's a non-masculinized, the pissing contest, right? Well, even
Okay.
that's kind of masculine, because I don't know how women win pissing contests. I'm sorry. Whatever it is that's not vulgar or gendered, it's so what? What it does do is it helps keep people informed of my show, and that makes me happy.
If
So
you weren't a DJ, what would you be doing with yourself?
I would probably be doing just be focusing on my efforts on personal development, on being the best fiance I can be, and being kind to people, reading and bettering myself, and just trying to play a lot of games and live a life that's kind of like aware of my place in things and how I can help others. I could, the DJing is just one way I've chosen to do that. But with the time I'm not DJing, it only goes to help. All the DJing is doing is helping give me one more activity and helping foster a sense of like giving back and trying to be a good person who collaborates with others. I'm still doing that in my spare time too, when I'm not a DJ, and so I would just be doing more of that, but through like gaming and trying to help communities and just trying to be patient and understanding.
Is there another career path that you could see yourself going down if you weren't a DJ?
Well, I do have my career, my day job, which is as currently as an API architect, although I just took a new offer with another company to become their chief engineer of software development.
Wow.
So that is the day job. Until I have a multinational media conglomerate at my back that's willing to sink in tons of existing capital into making me the next Zed, even 600,000 followers doesn't actually turn into rent money. it's awesome and it's wonderful and it's incredibly personally fulfilling. But I think that making money in the music business is very much either a reflection of already existing capital or a willingness to just do it all the way full time, which I do want to do one day. But my software engineering days aren't behind me just yet. I still like that very much as well.
Now, one other thing I've noticed about you is that in interviews or just in conversation, you refer to Spruik in the third person, or a lot of times in a way that makes him sound separate from you. Is there a difference between you, Bill Bolden, and DJ Spruik?
In my music, when I'm songwriting, I refer to myself as Spruik in the third person in my lyrics.
Okay.
And that in particular is because there's a bit of a personality to the singing Spruik. It exists in large part to help me explore painful emotions of, you know, wrestling with depression and anxiety and other difficult feelings. And that is sort of Spruik's business. And so there's a lot of songs, particularly in many places on Factor Friction and Lies Synth Pop Told Me, that refer to Spruik, which is kind of a depersonalization because it is not me as much as that entity. But the rest of the time, it's frankly just because it's a fun word and it feels good to say and it makes my mouth happy to say it.
Where did Spruik, or the name Spruik, come from?
That is a very cool story. I had a friend in high school who was a person who just didn't like music. They're rare, but we've all met a couple of them. People who just, you tell them this song is catchy or whatever, they just literally don't care. They have no room to be listening to music in their life. It doesn't do anything for them. And so he used to shut us up whenever we were all talking about music, because like most other teens, we were very into music. And he had a fictitious band named Spruik that was better than anything we listened to. And he would get us to shut up by talking about Spruik. So we would say things like, oh man, did you see that new Linkin Park video? That thing is so cool. I love that song. And he'd be like, oh yeah, that shit, that's, Spruik was doing that like 5 years ago. Spruik is the only band I'll listen to. And so I then, when I made my own project, chose the name Spruik just to troll him, because he had always said that Spruik was the only band he'd ever listened to, and they had all the best songs, and they were miles ahead of everyone else. And I'm like, so now you have to listen to me. And he's like, nope. That's where it's from. Where he got the name from, I have no idea. I think it's just a funny nonsense word.
And it is fun to say.
It is fun to say. Also, fortuitously, it does work out nicely in terms of getting you domain names and usernames on websites. So I always felt like that's a very good part about being, you know, Fish or Jadakiss or Spruik or any number of other misspelled things, you know? You don't really want to be like The Rejects or something. You're never going to get those words. Or the, which is like the funniest thing the first time you hear it. And then you're like, how do you show up in Google results? The who?
I can relate to that, especially as Estrus. Like 9 times out of 10, if you Google the word Estrus, it's going to have something to do with me. So I'm cool with that. And I can relate to that. Do you find that you respond more to Spruik? Like if we were to go to a bar together and somebody were to yell out Bill, would you be as likely to turn around as somebody yelled Spruik?
I would say equally likely for
yeah.
both. But there's increasingly a proportion of people who only know me as Spruik. Mm-hmm. And so I'm getting more used to being called Spruik in the company of people. Like when I was at Grand Prix Minneapolis, I got addressed as Spruik the entire weekend, not Bill, which it actually takes some getting used to. There's a weird moment where your chosen eponym or pseudonym is actually catching on, and it's kind of like, oh, cool. Right? Like at some point, Stephanie Germanelli or whatever got used to getting called Gaga. And I wonder, you know, how that felt for her.
Yeah, I can relate to that. There are people who still call me O from my WoW days because they couldn't pronounce estrus. So I still get a lot of O's. I was always I started off as a Moonkin, so for a while I was Big O. And yeah, I still get that once in a while. I'll get a tweet and they're like, you know, hey O, how's it going? Or you know, if I'm having a bad day, you know, keep your head up, O. And it's also gotten to the point where I get a little possessive, where I have another friend from my WoW days, and his character's name is Orvilus. And every once in a while, I will see a mutual follower who'll, hey, oh, good to see you. And I'm like, no. I'm O. That's Orvilus. Like, I may
There's
not.
25 other letters.
That's mine. And even ex-boyfriends. I have an ex-boyfriend who I met through WoW, and I moved out of state to be with him. And even when we lived together, it would be, hey, oh, you want to get dinner? We're friends now. He actually had we had we shared joint custody of a pet who recently passed away. And when he called me to give me the bad news, he was like, you know, hey, oh, I'm really sorry, I'm going to tell you this. And that's me. I will always be oh. I get it. So tell me about Bump in the Night. How'd that get started?
Bump in the Night just got started because shortly after I learned how to DJ, well, not that shortly, but after I'd been DJing a couple months, I was incredibly in love with it. I was just this, I knew this is what I wanted to do. You know how people always ask you about like relationships? They always ask, like, when did you know? And I feel like that question also applies to hobbies because sometimes, you know, you're like take up woodworking and you're like not doing it, and then you don't woodwork for a week and you never bother going back. But like with DJing, it was like, when did I know? And it was like there was a point 3 or 4 weeks in where I was doing it and I was just thinking, this is, I want to do this every week. I want to have a reason to always be doing it. I want to, you know, build myself around it and invest part of my personality in it, which is actually a tough thing to do, you know, because it involves some vulnerability to take a part of yourself and say, like, I'm gonna hang a little bit of my identity on this. This is gonna be part of who I am. But I decided I wanted to do that, you know, and put that out there for everyone to see. And it only took a couple episodes. I got some kinks worked out, sort of figured out what I was doing, settled into a really comfortable feeling. And now there's just so much momentum behind it, I can hardly stop. So, for people who haven't listened to Bump in the Night, quick overview. It is every week, without fail. It's been going since December of 2012. So well over 18 months now. So almost getting to be 100 weeks total. It's always an hour of through mixed electro music by me. So curated by me. Like I do the work of choosing and finding all new tracks every week, from progressive house, electro house, and other genres. And then also, you know, through mixed by me. So for people who aren't really acquainted with, you know, just DJ culture, but doing that thing where you seamlessly mix them so that you can't tell where one track begins and another ends, and it just creates a solid hour-long block of music that just goes. And so it comes every Monday morning on both MTGcast, where it's on the front page, and also iTunes, and also on the Buffalo Musicians streaming radio website, Wax Museum Radio. And every week there's always a track we call out as the bump of the week, the best track of that whole week. There's shout outs. I offer my helpful commentary on what I think of the tracks as I spin them. And it's just generally a lot of fun. It's good for workouts, it's good for studying, it's good for driving. Apparently kids like crumping to it. I don't even know what that is, but I've been told that by multiple crump masters or parents, as I like to call them. And we're up to episode 53 of Bump in the Night proper. The other weeks have been live rips of my concerts, so you can hear right from the soundboard what it was like when I played out at a show that week. Or sometimes special features. like weeks centered around particular artists or particular subgenres, or the special anthology episodes, which I make every so often, that are composed of only the bumps of the week from previous Bump in the Night episodes, so that there are nothing but the best tracks all in one block.
How do you choose what song makes the cut each week?
I listen to a lot of music. I have a to be listened to queue. There's a whole. Do you use Trello for task management?
I don't.
Okay, well, it's a task manager similar to many, personal organization managers. But there's this whole workflow and project I have set up just for Bump in the Night. I listen to lots of other DJs. I listen to the charts every week. I listen to blogs and tastemakers. I probably invest a total of 10 to 12 hours every week just continually listening to EDM at all times. And I have a system of like a pipeline I put things in, like to be considered, to be evaluated, sorted into buckets, then arranged by key, then purchased, and then put in the queue. So I've always got things coming to make sure that there's always several episodes worth of tracks coming up. They're always full of new music and that they will mix into each other. It's a surprising, it's actually a lot of fun. I like the preparation. And it seems like work if you saw me doing it, but it isn't. It's what I'd rather be doing the most, 'cause I get to listen to techno all the time.
So, in magic circles, you're most well known for The Gatherin, which you formed with Patrick Chapin. Tell me how that got started.
The Gathering started when I had decided independently in 2007 or so that it was time to merge my favorite hobbies of music and magic, and that I had to make, songs about Magic the Gathering because I liked magic so much and I liked making music. And of course, it's natural to want to make music about Magic the Gathering. Shuffle 'Em Up was the first, never was on the Pro Tour, was incredibly cathartic, and that was second. And then still had all these and tracks like those. It was just a great way for me to tell my stories that in many ways are shared Magic player stories, because who among us can't identify with had all these or Shuffle 'Em Up? But it came time to reach out to Chapin when I noticed him in one of his Star City Games premium articles, just mentioning like it would be really cool if somebody made music about Magic. There's already so much media about Magic. I would be down for making music about one. Maybe I'll do that one day. And I just sent him a Facebook message and said, "I saw that you were interested in doing this. I'm halfway there. I've got an album half made. Would you like to do it with me?" And Chapin, being the adventurous guy he is like, "Yes, I do." And we flew him out to Buffalo to try him out in the studio together. We actually had incredible chemistry, worked really well. We found ourselves bouncing ideas off each other and just kind of making magic in the studio. All of a sudden, we were making Innovate and Jace the Mind Sculptor, and partnership was born. So, honestly, I say in one lyric in the song "Hymn to Turok," I guess a bedroom DJ just needed Chapin to help him because it started with a Facebook message and with an album. And sometimes I still can't believe it that I just sent an unsolicited message to world traveling Pro Tour top aiding celebrity and being like, "Do this cool thing with me." But it was cool and it worked out. And I'm really happy to have contributed to magic culture with The Gathering, which is just the really cool lasting thing about it is that there's some stuff like I think had all these and particularly Jace the Mind Sculptor, there's parts of magic culture that it was cool to have my fingerprints on. It is a really great community, and I'm happy to have contributed to it in some way. Which is a feeling that I'm sure you're very well acquainted with, of course.
Yeah, I message pros randomly all the time and say, come do something awesome with me. It's how you get it done. Then they're really open to doing that. So, with that said, though, the songs that you and Patrick did were a hit. People really enjoyed them. Are there any plans to do another album, maybe with him or anyone else?
Oh, there are. This is one of the most common questions I get, and the answer is always yes. Everyone here is still very much talking about it, and there are some things in the works, actually. It shouldn't be too much longer now. Granted, Chapin has a nasty habit of winning pro tours
Ugh.
and getting married and getting into the Hall of Fame. And seriously, you should talk
What a
about that.
jerk.
And I seem to have caught a similar problem, what with my recent purchase of a house and an upcoming marriage of my own and career changes.
See, marriage ruins everything.
But I beg to differ. I'm marrying my best friend and favorite magic opponent.
I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Yes, it's a Magic the Gathering marriage, gotta say.
Well, if you need like a sexy female vocalist, I'd be down for a lot of techno songs have like that de facto female vocalist. One of my favorite groups ever. Are you familiar with the group called IIO?
I am not. What
Okay.
genre?
Oh God. It's probably, amateur stuff to you, but they were known for a couple dance songs. The biggest one was called Rapture. That was a worldwide smash. And then they did a song called At the End. And yeah, Rapture was pretty big, but I loved their lead vocalist. So if you need somebody breathy and sexy to just like talk in songs and be that techno girl, I'm your girl,
I'll remember that, Aaron.
Sprook. I'm just saying we can help each other out. Because my followers go where I tell them to go. So if I say, hey, I'm on this track, they're going to go.
You have an outspoken Twitter following, and I have very much liked life ever since I became a member of the original Estrus Army. Things are very outspoken there. I like it very much.
I enjoy you very much too. So, where do you go from here, Spruik? Like, where's the plan? Where do you see yourself in a year, 2 years, 3 years? Walk me through it.
Frankly, I know I keep at it with bump in the night. I really want to crest some big numbers, although I think that's more just for the purpose of milestones than any kind of concrete accomplishment, because I know what it felt like to cross, 10,000 and 100,000 listeners. So I don't know how surprised I'll be to cross 1 million, but I want to get there. That'd be pretty cool. I really want to focus more on touring out and being able to build the fan base in real life. So I know that the listeners and the fans are there, but since I'm not going to be partnering with any big time money-backed media moguls, I'm learning the business end of this thing on my own. And it's been very fun learning how to just go on the road and start calling up venues and cities and saying, book me and comp me, and how to pack all my stuff in the back of a train and take my equipment on the road. I want to get, more tours under my belt, hit more GPs. I was very upset when I wasn't that upset, actually. I felt blessed because it was cool to even come within range of it. But when I was in the finals of that PTQ and I had to concede rather than play it out because it was for Pro Tour M15, which was on the day of a wedding that I'm the best man in. And so going was strictly not an option. I've always wanted to be on the Pro Tour, and that is the closest I've been. And I really would like to strike gold twice, this time for a wedding that has no pro, or a Pro Tour that has no wedding associated with it. And so, other than that, I can't wait to be married to my best friend. And just the person of my dreams and the best human being I know.
Aw, thank you, Sprook. Oh, you meant,
Oh,
sorry.
hey. Not you, although you're pretty cool too. that's other than that, just keep making music and keep just living a gratitude-filled life where I take time to be kind to people and remember to smile. And yeah, I don't know. I'm doing that thing now where I'm not very eloquent because I'm thinking about the purpose of life. But the point is, more Bump in the Nights. Those are not stopping. There will be more originals. There will be more chiptunes. And I will be on the Pro Tour.
Okay. Well, I'm definitely rooting for you, Spruik, and especially with an attitude as positive as yours, that's as infectious as yours. I can't imagine anybody who wouldn't root for you. So.
Oh, thank you, Aaron.
And thank you so much for coming on the show. It has been a lot of fun getting to know you, and hopefully I run into you again. Like I said, I ran into you a little bit at Minneapolis, but we were either playing or you were busy spinning and I didn't want to bother you. And are you going to be at Boston?
Boston is one I want to make it to, but I'm gonna leave it as a game time decision because of the aforementioned upcoming house purchase, which is supposed to go through right around then.
Okay.
So, you know, there's a lot of plates I'm spinning right now.
Well, I will be
So,
at Boston.
Boston will be what happens if I'm not closing on a house that weekend.
All right. Well, I will be at Boston along with some other fabulous folks, and then I'm taking a break for a while. I may go to GP Joyzy because the playmat is awesome, and I have several friends who are going, and it's Joyzy, so you can't not go to Joyzy. And it's Legacy, so I'd like to finally get around to trying Legacy, and I have friends who are offering to loan me a deck if I want to, and I'm excited. It seems like a fun format.
When is Josie?
Joyzy, I believe it's the November 22nd. Yeah, the weekend of the 22nd, I believe.
By November, I'll definitely be all career changed it and wedding planned it and house closed it. And so I think I might go test dust off my legacy deck. I do like to get me in some legacy about once a month. It'll be fun.
Yeah, but it's Joyzy though, Spruik. I mean, come on. I'm gonna be fist pumping. You gotta spin something, you know? You gotta get Jersey Shore with it.
Oh, I'll definitely bring out the big room techno pickaxe and stuff. I will mix Martin Garrix's Animals into Martin Garrix's Animal.
Well, now I have to go to Jersey. If you're going to be there and you're going to do that, I have to. I have
I
to.
will look into it. All right. Well, thank you very much for having me, Aaron.
Absolutely. And if anybody has enjoyed what they've heard here on the Deck Tees, you can always find the show first and foremost on gatheringmagic.com. The show is available on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Please subscribe and leave me a review and some stars. You can follow the show on Twitter at the Deck Tees. You can follow me on Twitter at Original Estrus. That is OriginalOestrus. You can also email me at estrus@elitistjerks.com. Spruik, where can they find you?
Most notably and first and foremost at twitter.com/spruke. That is spruke, SPRUKE. And I am spruke on every site, particularly all music sites. So social media wise, I am twitter.com/spruke, facebook.com/spruke, soundcloud.com/spruke, and also youtube.com/spruke, which has all the Gathering music videos and all Spruik music videos available to be listened to there. And my music can be found in iTunes under Spruik or under The Gathering. It can be found also on Pandora, Spotify, Amazon Music, eMusic, Napster, the new Beats Music, and pretty much every other music store there is. The podcast is Bump in the Night with DJ Spruik. It's on the front page of MTGcast and in the iTunes podcast directory. You just have to scroll by the unpopular 1970s animated TV show Bump in the Night, which I seem completely unable to beat. I think because they're a TV show and it's tough for a podcast to beat a TV show. I don't know. And then also finally on Wax Museum Radio, which is the live 24/7 streaming site of music from all Buffalo DJs. My show runs on there at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on Fridays.
And there you have it, folks. Thank you so much for listening, and please take care of yourselves, okay? Bye.